I hear people talking bad about the way we have to live here in this country. Harping on wars we fight and griping about the way things ain't gonna be. Tonight I don't mind them switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. When they're running down my country, man, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down the way of life, I'm fighting in the fog of dynasty. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. You're running down my country, man. You're walking on the fight inside me. I read about some squirrely guy who claims he just don't believe in the fight. And I wonder just how long the rest of us can count on being free. They love our milk and honey, but they preach about some other way of living. When they're running down my country horse, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down the way of life, I'm fighting. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. When you're running down my country, man, you're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down the way of life, I'm fighting in the fog of dynasty. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. When you're running down my country, man, you're walking on the fight beside me.
Yes, when you're running down my country, you're walking down the fighting side of me. And that's the name of this program here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Well, I'm in the beautiful Okanagan Valley in the southern part of British Columbia right now. And happening to be listening to NPR, that's public radio, out of the state of Washington. And they were interviewing some author. And this author's claim to fame was that she was had written a book about the importance of eroticism in life and in giving you a reason for living and so on. Now, I didn't catch her name, and I couldn't give you much more of a summary of the topic than this. But anyway, her claim to fame, though, was that her parents were both both survivors of the Holocaust. And she grew, and they apparently clung to some form of eroticism that gave them a reason to live, and so on and so on. Well, what particularly intrigued me was they were both the only members of their family to survive the so-called Holocaust. Now, you might find that unusual. Both were would be the only members. You won't believe how many times I've read that same story. It's almost a ritual. My father was the only person who, of his whole family, who survived the Holocaust. And then a little bit further on in the same account, you'll read, actually a brother of his survived. And years later, they found a sister. And in other words, it's just a good old-fashioned lie. Years and years and years ago, several generations ago, to sort of polish up your credentials with the younger generation and to show how hard you'd had it compared to their soft existence, it was not unusual for people to say, when I was a boy, I walked 10 miles a day to school. Sometimes you add a further detail, in my bare feet, in the middle of winter. And, you know, frankly, physically speaking. No human being could walk 10 miles twice a day in sub-zero, sub-freezing weather, without frostbite. But these details would be laid on thick, to produce skill. I only throw that out as a warning that you have to listen carefully. Well, here's a story from Canada's National Post of a couple of days ago. Court will not hear Canadian fighting U.S. extradition. Okay. A Canadian who is fighting extradition to the state of Washington to face a murder charge has been denied permission to appeal to the Supreme Court of Canada. The court rejected the application of transgendered inmate Kevin Patterson, who identifies as female and uses the name Rachel. Patterson is charged in the state of Washington with a 2014 bludgeoning death of its roommate. And BC Appeal Court documents show that he, who identifies as a female, he fled to Abbotsford, British Columbia, but was quickly arrested and has remained in custody. Patterson, opposed the extradition on several grounds, including that he wasn't given U.S. diplomatic assurances of protection against harm potentially suffered by transgendered prisoners in either male or female prisons. Because you're basically mentally mixed up, sexually mixed up, and are frankly a freak, you want special protection. Well, perhaps he's a born he, act as a he, and leave your transgendered delusions at the prison door, and you might not be in any special danger if you're convicted. Anyway, I class that as one small victory for common sense. Small, but yeah, it's a victory. Oh, yeah, here's a black pastor, black principal. We talked about this on the Ethno State, which comes out every Tuesday, and I put it out, it's on the Canada First Immigration Reform Committee website, and you go http://canadafirst.nfshost.com. Anyway, this is a story about a black principal in Florida. Florida high school principal was removed from his job and reassigned Monday after writing in an email to a parent that he couldn't, quote, say the Holocaust is a factual historical event. The decision came amid a firestorm of criticism and after he had apologized and even after he spent a few days at the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum. I mean, we are dealing with a fanatical religion. It's the religion of Holocaust. In the most fervent days of the Middle Ages, it's hard to imagine the self-flagellatory punishment that a person felt he had to do just to save himself. He said this principle, and probably the only reason he survived is he's black. And I don't begrudge him that. He wrote to a parent, he couldn't say that that the Holocaust is a factual historical event. Well, there's a wise guy. I don't mean a wise guy, but there's a wise man. Historical factual evidence of the Holocaust. It's a hazy thing. Well, what is it? Well, if by the Holocaust you mean 6 million deliberately exterminated by Adolf Hitler, and that this was the worst crime in human history, every one of the things I've just said is false. And I won't go into all the reasons why. So, fearing the firestorm, he's a heretic. He thought, well, maybe if I go on my knees to the shrine and whip myself bloody, they'll give me some, they'll extend some mercy. Okay, he didn't whip himself bloody, but he at his own expense, spent a few days at the U.S. Holocaust Museum. Had to go all the way, of course, from Florida to Washington, D.C. Anyway, the story continues. Principal William Latson of Spanish River Community High School in Palm Beach, Palm Beach County, well, that's very, very heavily Jewish, was removed from his position and will be given a district job, at least temporarily, school system officials said. state legislators have called for Lotson to be fired. Oh, why? In a private email. He said he had some, how did he put it exactly? He said that he couldn't say that the Holocaust is a factual historical event. That's all he said. You know, if he said, I don't believe in Jesus Christ. No, whatever. Almost any other assertion that he could have made would be, whatever, it's his opinion. But no, this. Why does the folk history of a foreign people become ours, the religion we must believe in? Hey, you're totally free to believe in the Lord Jesus Christ, or you believe in Buddhism or Hinduism with many gods, or no god at all. And most people will simply say, well, you know, it's your choice, it's your conscience. But why this? Why would normally semi-sensible people be in a frothing rage over the fact that this fellow doesn't know of historical evidence that the so-called Holocaust happened? Well, it shows our dispossession and our rule by foreigners. Controversy erupted over statements Lotson made to a parent who then emailed him asking about the Holocaust education at the school in Boca Raton, which has a large Jewish population. One of his messages said, I can't say the Holocaust is a factual historical event because I'm not in the position to do so as a school district employee. He also said, not everyone believes the Holocaust happened. Well, he's absolutely accurate about that. It's now, I've seen Jewish sources complain that something like 20 to 25% of Americans don't know what the Holocaust is or don't believe it happened. Well, all the principals said was factually true. And what he perhaps was also driving at, now this is my interpretation, not his, is that maybe there shouldn't be indoctrination in the public schools about what is essentially a religion. The so-called Holocaust is the folk history of the Jewish people. It's part of their tribal history. I should say it's their tribal history. It has been forced upon us as a religion. Anyway, so far, so good, he survived. Now, today is July the 14th, and that is the anniversary of the storming of the Bastille 130 years ago, July 14, 1789. And that, that set off something that was called the French Revolution. Now, in common popular history, as it's come down to us, the French Revolution was a good thing. Most people would have trouble exactly explaining why, but it's come down to us as a good thing. I'm going to give you a bit of a history of the French Revolution and then suggest to you, in fact, that it was not a good thing. It was bad. And I'll explain why. The French Revolution was a watershed event in modern European history. And it began in 1789 and ended in a little over a decade later with the ascent of Napoleon Bonaparte. In fact, it was 10 years of madness, of turmoil, upheaval, and madness, which saw the overthrow of the French monarchy, the murder of the French king, Louis XVI, and his wife, Austrian-born woman, Marie Antoinette, the execution of tens of thousands of Christians, aristocrats, and even many of the original revolutionaries. And it's perhaps out of that it's out of that, the madness that many people, or it was the observation was made, that the revolution eventually eats its own. You know, revolutions are insane times of incredible violence, of arbitrariness, of people denounced and immediately hauled off to be executed by the new machine of execution, the guillotine. It was also a time of the turning or overturning of most traditional Christian norms. At one point during the madness of the terror during the revolution, a notorious French prostitute was paraded naked on a platform through the streets of Paris with the crown, as she was crowned the goddess of reason. The revolution in many had a number of factors, but it was not really, as sometimes it's portrayed, the oppressed poor and peasants rising up against the king and the aristocracy for a better way of life. Essentially, the leadership of the French Revolution was not angry peasants or workers, but Freemasons. And it was a conspiracy against both a monarchy and the church, a conspiracy that continues in many ways under different forms to this day. Anyway, during this period, French citizens raised and redesigned their country's political landscape, uprooting centuries-old institutions such as absolute monarchy and the feudal system. The upheaval was caused by widespread discontent with the French monarchy and the poor economic policies of King Louis XVI, who met his death by guillotine, as did his wife Marie Antoinette. Although it failed to achieve all its goals and at times degenerated into a chaotic bloodbath, the French Revolution did play an important role in the creation of the modern world. As the 18th century drew to a close, France's costly involvement in the American Revolution and extravagant spending by King Louis XVI and his predecessor had left the country on the verge of bankruptcy. And I might just toss in an aside here. This is an important warning about the sort of international meddling that we have seen the United States involved in wars for Israel, two in Iraq, one in Afghanistan. The cost in Iraq alone is something in the neighborhood of $2 trillion. Now, you heard that right, not million, not billion, $1 trillion, $2 trillion. The entirety of America's aging infrastructure could have been rebuilt for that. How much stronger and better America would have been? Anyway, these things cost. Not only were the royal coffers depleted, but two decades of poor harvests, drought, cattle diseases, and skyrocketing bread prices had kindled unrest among the peasants and the urban poor. Many expressed their desperation and resentment toward a regime that imposed heavy taxes yet failed to provide any relief by rioting, looting, and striking. In the fall of 1786, Louis XVI's Controller General Charles-Alexandre de Calonne proposed a financial reform package that included a universal land tax from which the privileged classes would no longer be exempt. To garner support for these measures and forestall a growing aristocratic revolt, the king summoned the Etats Généraux, the National Assembly, an assembly representing France's clergy, nobility, and middle class, for the first time since 1614, so first time in almost 150 years. The meeting was scheduled for May 5th, 1789. In the meantime, delegates of the three estates from each locality would compile lists of grievances, cahiers de doléances, to present to the king. The three estates, houses of the estates general, were the aristocracy, the clergy, and the middle class. The rise of the third estate. France's population had changed considerably since 1614. The non-aristocratic members of the Third Estate now represent 98% of the people, but could still be outvoted by the two other bodies. In the lead-up to the May 5th meeting, the Third Estate began to mobilize support for equal representation and the abolishment of the noble veto. In other words, they wanted voting by head and not by status. While all of the orders shared a common desire for fiscal and judicial reform, as well as a more representative form of government, the nobles in particular were loath to give up the privilege they enjoyed under the traditional system. By the time the Estates General convened at Versailles, the highly public debate over its voting process had erupted into hostility between the three estates, eclipsing the original purpose of the meeting and the authority of the man who had convened it. On June 17th, with talks over the procedure stalled, the third estate, that's the basically the representatives of the middle class, met alone and formally adopted the title of National Assembly. 3 days later, they met in a nearby indoor tennis court and took the so-called tennis court oath, Serment du jeu de pomme, vowing not to disperse until constitutional reform had been achieved. Within a week, most of the clerical deputies and 47 liberal nobles had joined them, and on June 27th, 1789, Louis XVI grudgingly absorbed all three orders into the new assembly. On June 12th, as the National Assembly, known as the National Constituent Assembly, during its work on the Constitution, continued to meet at Versailles, fear and violence consumed the capital. Though enthusiastic about the recent breakdown of royal power, Parisians grew panicked at rumors of an impending military coup. A popular insurgency culminated on July 14th when rioters stormed the Bastille fortress in an attempt to secure gunpowder and weapons. Many considered this event, now commemorated in France as a national holiday, as the start of the French Revolution. Now, there's something important about the storming of the Bastille. First of all, the point was not to free the prisoners, although there were some prisoners kept there, but basically to get weaponry. It has come down in popular legend, the story of the freeing of the prisoners. Well, the Bastille was not a particularly harsh prison. Prisoners actually had apartments there, not cells. They were not chained to the wall or anything like that. In fact, the grand hall of the storming of the Bastille was seven prisoners. I think one or two lunatics, a rake, that is a very sexually promiscuous person, who was in there for some of his behavior, and I believe, and I might be wrong, the Marquis de Sade. So not exactly a grand hall, and they certainly weren't political prisoners. The wave of revolutionary fervor and widespread hysteria quickly spread to the countryside. Revolting against years of exploitation, peasants looted and burned the homes of tax collectors, landlords, and the seigneurial elite, or the aristocratic elite. Known as the Great Fear, La Grande Peur, the agrarian insurrection hastened the growing exodus of nobles from the country and inspired the National Constituent Assembly to abolish feudalism on August the 4th, 1789, signing what the historian Georges Lefebvre later called the death certificate of the old order. So the feudal system of landowners and peasants with obligations to the landowners was essentially abolished. What would occur peacefully in much of Europe, and especially England, occurred violently in France. So reform that and changes that occurred that would take place over a period of time and largely peacefully elsewhere were achieved violently. On August 4th, the Assembly adopted the Declaration of the Rights of Man and of the Citizen, Déclaration des Droits de l'Homme et du Citoyen, a statement of democratic principles and grounded in the philosophical and political ideas of the Enlightenment and thinkers like Jean-Jacques Rousseau, who was, and on some other program I'll discuss it, an idiot. I mean, but many of his nonsensical but very dangerous ideas to this day are quite powerful, including the idea that all people are equal. The document proclaimed the Assembly's commitment to replace the ancien regime, or the old order, with a regime based on equal opportunity, freedom of speech, popular sovereignty, and representative government. Well, whatever the good goals back then were, certainly France does not have free speech today. Patriots are jailed for questioning the tribal story of another group, namely the so-called Holocaust. Drafting a formal constitution proved much more of a challenge for the National Constituent Assembly, which had the added burden of functioning as a legislature during harsh economic times. Yes, it's one thing to overthrow the government, it's another thing to actually run a country. For months, its members wrestled with fundamental questions about the shape and expanse of France's new political landscape. For instance, who would be responsible for electing delegates? Would the clergy owe allegiance to the Catholic Church or the French government? Perhaps most importantly, how much authority would the king, his public image further weakened after a failed attempt to flee the country in June 1791, retain? So at this point, he was, 2 years after, he was still the king. Adopted on September 3rd, 1791, France's first written constitution echoed the more moderate voices in the assembly, establishing a constitutional monarchy in which the king enjoyed royal veto and the ability to appoint ministers. This compromise did not sit well with the influential radicals like Maximilien de Robespierre, Camille Desmoulins, and Georges Danton, who began drumming up popular support for a more republican form of government and for the trial of Louis XVI. Now, this is very similar to what would happen 120 years further on in Russia. An initial revolution with somewhat vague liberal goals, quickly supplanted by a more radical, violent revolution, which ended in the murder of the monarch, in the case of the Russian monarch, the murder of Tsar Nicholas II, his wife, or Tsarina Alexandra, and their, I believe, five children. In April 1792, the newly elected Legislative Assembly declared war on Austria and Prussia, where it believed the French émigrés were building counter-revolutionary alliances. It also hoped to spread its revolutionary ideals across Europe through warfare. The same pattern the communists, yeah, the Russian communists would follow 120 years later. On the domestic front, meanwhile, the political crisis took a radical turn when a group of insurgents led by the extremist Jacobin attacked the royal residence in Paris and arrested the king on August the 10th, 1792. The following month, amid a wave of violence in which Parisian revolutionaries massacred hundreds of accused counter-revolutionaries, the Legislative Assembly was replaced by the National Convention, which proclaimed the abolition of the monarchy and the establishment of the French Republic. On January 21st, 1793, it sent King Louis XVI, condemned to death for high treason and crimes against the state, to the guillotine. His wife, Marie Antoinette, suffered the same fate 9 months later. The Reign of Terror, and this, of course, is what happened in Russia as well in the late 19-teens and the early 1920s, and in Red China. Following the king's execution, war with various European powers and intense divisions within the National Assembly ushered the French Revolution into its most violent and turbulent phase. In June 1793, the Jacobins, these are the extreme radicals, seized control of the National Convention with the more moderate Girondins from the more moderates, let's say, who were called the Girondins, and instituted a series of radical measures, including the establishment of a new calendar and the eradication of Christianity. Again, similarities to communism. Everything was to be changed. They also unleashed the bloody reign of terror, La Terreur, a 10-month period in which suspected enemies of the revolution were guillotined by the thousands. Now, that would be again repeated in communist Russia, in communist China, you're enemies of the people. Or if you're enemy of the people, anyway, you could be executed, or would be executed, and merely it could be completely arbitrary, just to be denounced as an enemy of the people, an aristo, that's a... could have you executed. Many of the killings were carried out under orders from Robespierre, who dominated the draconian Committee of Public Safety, until his own execution a year later, on July 28, 1794, a good example of the revolution eating its own. And interestingly, the Committee of Public Terror is dubbed the Committee of Public Safety. His death marked the beginning of the Thermidorian reaction, a moderate phase in which the French people revolted against the reign of terror's excesses. On August 22, 1795, the National Convention, largely composed of Girondins who had survived the reign of terror, approved a new constitution that created France's first bicameral legislature, so a Senate and the National Assembly. Executive power would lie in the hands of a 5-member directory, or directoire, appointed by Parliament. Royalists and Jacobin protested the new regime, but were swiftly silenced by the army, now led by a young and successful general named Napoleon. The directory's 4 years in power were riddled with financial crises, popular discontent, inefficiency, and above all, political corruption. By the late 1790s, the directors relied almost entirely on the military to maintain their authority and had ceded much of their power to the generals in the field. On November 9, 1799, as frustration with their leadership reached a fever pitch, Napoleon staged a coup d'etat, abolishing the directory and appointing himself as France's first consul, like in ancient Rome. The event marked the end of the French Revolution and the beginning of the Napoleonic era, in which France would come to dominate much of continental Europe. There are some interesting things in that. Many in other European countries, particularly in England, feared that the virus of revolution would spread. In the 19th century, there were several efforts to bring back the monarchy, and substantial sections of French society, in many rural areas, traditional Christians, Catholics, were never reconciled to the French Revolution. It remains an institution somewhat like institutions in our country, that political correctness that people pay lip service to, but don't in fact support. The slogans of the French Revolution: liberté, égalité, fraternité, liberty or freedom, equality, and brotherhood, were very typical of the Masonic ideas that were spread by the Enlightenment before the French Revolution, and ideas spread by a particular madman named Jean-Jacques Rousseau, whose ideas were and remain incredibly powerful. His ideas led to communism. For instance, he proclaimed that all men are equal. That there has seldom been a more self-evidently nonsensical proposition. unless you mean in a religious sense, that God loves us all. Well, frankly, I don't know that, but okay, I can accept that may be true. Or that we should be equal before the law. Now, that's an ideal. We know that's not the case, but wealthy people like the person who was picked up on numerous sex charges involving abuse of children, pedophilia. I think his name is Jeffrey Epstein this week. In previous run-ins with the law, was treated with kid gloves because of his great wealth. But anyway, okay. But what about the proposition that all people are equal? Well, if you believe that, I have a bridge linking Manhattan to Brooklyn that I would like to sell you for $10 million. We're gloriously unequal and different. However, Rousseau's delusion went like this. All men are equal. And he said, well, man originally had been a noble savage. He lived in the woods, peaceful, alone, not knowing fellow, noble savages, doing harm to no one and nothing, a gentle little hippie. Well, okay, you look around and, well, where's Noble Savage? Well, he's not around anymore because society has put him in chains. Society's and its rules and regulations had restricted him. And so if we could just get rid of society, like in other words, have a revolution, like the French Revolution, get rid of the church, get rid of the aristocracy, get rid of the old regime, well, then all would be well, and we would have Noble Savage again. Well, it's a charming story, but it's complete nonsense. By the time Rousseau was scribbling these types of things after 1750, European man had explored almost every corner of the known world. Not quite everywhere, but almost. Most of Latin America, much of Africa, some of Asia, North America, and no matter where European man, French, English, Italian, Spanish, Portuguese, no matter where they went, nowhere did they find anybody who acted or looked like Noble Savage. Now, Rousseau was an educated man. He had to know that. So he's just writing nonsense. In fact, the peoples that Europeans encountered, particularly, but not only, in North America, were, for the most part, backward, miserable, disease-ridden, near-starving, Stone Age savages. In fact, the great English writer, Thomas Hobbes, wrote that the life of a primitive man was, quote, mean, nasty, brutish, and short. Mean, like, with very little. Nasty, not very happy. Brutish, marked by terrible things like cannibalism and tortures and so on. And short. Yeah, nothing to hold up as a noble savage. I wish we could get back to that type of thing. Just the opposite. Dreadful. However, okay, notice the little bit of mental gymnastics. So, man was once a noble savage. Okay, we look around today, we don't see any noble savage. Well, how can we get back to that? Well, what's keeping him from being noble savage, where all men are equal and peaceful and good and loving, kind, etc., is, well, Rousseau said, society. Well, get rid of society as we know it. Overthrow religion, overthrow the monarchy, overthrow the aristocracy, and we will all be big, happy, peaceful hippies doing a kumbaya moment together. Well, of course, it didn't happen. I might say about Rousseau's account of the noble savage What should have struck, even the most casual reader, as nonsense. If Noble Savage wanders around the woods solitary, alone, he's not really part of a society. How did Little Noble Savages come about? Well, does he just lie down under a palm tree one night and after a few heaves, Little Noble Savage emerges in the morning? I mean, as an account of human history, it's just wacko. Anyway, 140 years later, well, actually, maybe half a century later, Karl Marx, the Jewish founder of communism, would pick up the same thread, saying that, well, all men are equal. Well, you look around, and in fact, they're not equal. Some are rich, some are poor, etc. Well, what's the reason? Well, instead of challenging the original idea that maybe all people are not equal, you come up with a scapegoat or an excuse. Well, the excuse was capitalism. So all men would be equal if you could just kill all the landlords, kill all the businessmen, and then everybody would have an equal share. They have an equal share of poverty. But that delusion was very, very powerful and led to communism, which blighted the human condition for the next nearly the next 150 years. And then eventually cultural Marxism, perhaps the worst of all. I'll deal with that again on other programs. So I'm going to take my musical break right now, and I guess we would be remiss if we didn't play the anthem of the French Revolution, La Marseillaise. That's the song of Marseille, and it's a rousing song, celebrating the revolution, the brotherhood of the revolutionaries, and so on. Not a very good cause. This is sung by a great English, a great French singer, they called her La Môme Piaf, and that means the little sparrow. Great singer. This is the version of the Marseillaise by Edith Piaf, who died all too young in the very early 1960s. Very fascinating.
Ready to see the world? Air Canada flies to 6 continents and more than 200 destinations.
Sneak their ad into my show tonight, but here we are. This is the French national anthem by Edith Piaf.
Marchons, marchons, que sans pur, amoureux,
Great Edith Piaf, and that's the Marseillaise. And this is a song of a great moment in France when a great patriot, Marshal Louis Pétain, or Maréchal Pétain, did a patriotic deal with the Germans after they invaded in 1940 to overthrow the corrupt government of France at the time. They occupied a bit of France, but most of France remained under independent French control in alliance with Germany. This is Marshal Pétain's government in Vichy. Now, of course, it would be today, it comes down in history as a something of a collaborationist government. It was not. It was a patriotic government which maintained French sovereignty. And this is a rousing song. It was almost the national anthem of the Vichy government. It's called Marshal, We Are Here For You, Maréchal, Nous Voilà. And hope you like it. It's in French, but it's a rousing song, Maréchal, Nous Voilà, which is roughly, we're here for you. He commanded tremendous loyalty at the time. This is Marshal Louis Pétain.
Une flamme sacrée monte du sol natal et la France enivrée. Tous tes enfants qui t'aiment et vénèrent tes ans, à ton appel suprême, ont répondu présent. Maréchal, nous voilà devant toi, le sauveur de la France. Nous jurons, nous tes gars, de servir et de suivre tes pas. Maréchal, nous voilà, tu nous as reçus. espérante, la patrie renaîtra. Maréchal, maréchal, nous voilà. Tu as lutté sans cesse pour le salut commun. On parle avec tendresse du héros de Verdun. Donnant ta vie, ton génie et ta foi, tu sauves la patrie une seconde fois. Maréchal,
maréchal,
nous voilà,
voilà
devant toi, le sauveur de la France. Nous jurons,
nous t'égards,
de servir et de suivre tes pas.
Pretty much the informal anthem of Vichy France, Maréchal, nous voilà, or Marshal, he was a great hero of the First World War. We're behind you. It's colloquial, very roughly translated. But I play a song. This kind of harkens back to my show for July the 12th, and this is is a reflection on the tremendous involvement of the Ulster royalists. They're very, very loyal to the English crown. Protestants celebrating the 12th of July, the victory in July 12th, 1690, when William of Orange defeated, who was a Protestant, defeated Catholic James III at the Battle of Boyne. And securing Protestantism in Ireland, particularly Northern Ireland. And as this began to be, Protestantism began to be threatened by an Irish nationalist movement in the south, the men of Ulster became more staunchly loyal to the British crown. And when war came in August of 1914, Ulster raised an entire division, the 36th Division of the British Army, and they saw battle on the 1st of July at the Battle of the Somme, the 1st of July 1916. It was a massacre. Now, they acquitted themselves very bravely, but they sacrificed a great deal in the First World War, and when they came back, they found that political assurances that had been given to them had not been kept. And this is a very bitter song under an Englishman's command, that maybe it had been a mistake to so sacrifice themselves for England, an ungrateful, but many Ulstermen saw as an ungrateful power. A very bitter song, but very, very powerful. You might want to get the video version of it. There's some great footage there, and this is called Under an Englishman's Command. This is Paul Fromm, and you're on the Fighting Side of Me here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. And the connections are the internet feeds are a little slow. Here we are.
This 1st of July morn, when Ulster men are rightly proud of the land where they were born, I'll tell you of our volunteers and how it came to pass. As he went to fight for England's cause, far away from old Belfast. It was in the dark, uncertain days of early World War I, when England's shores were threatened by the jack boot of the Hun. When England's cry for help was heard, we bid her not no fear. For across the Flanders fields we will send our Ulster volunteers. It was at a place they call the Somme on the first day of July, when 20,000 Ulster men prepared to fight and die. Sure, they bravely charged through no man's land with the red and flying high. With the cry of no surrender, boys, old Ulster's battle cries. Now those Germans in their trenches deep could scarce believe they rise. When up and charged those Ulster men, and they heard their battle cries. What kind of men are those, they said, who would leave their native land just to die upon this battlefield? And what is that strange red hand? Now on and on they fought that day, where others feared to tread. And on the wire and in the mud, they left behind their dead. But the only flag to fly that day behind those German lines was the old red hand of Ulster, with the shamrocks round her name. Now those who lived came home again. What changes did they all find? For the counties that made Ulster up no longer numbered nine. Three counties had been sold away by those they fought to save. Yes, this was England's gratitude for the sacrifice they made. So gather round, my comrades, on this first of July morn, when Ulster men are rightly proud of a land where they were born. For they'll never more be led away to fight in foreign lands, or to die for someone else's cause at an English man's command, or die for someone else's cause at an English man's command.
That's the under an Englishman's command. This is Paul Fromm. You're on the Fighting Side of Me. Back with you again tomorrow, same time, midnight Eastern time. The shows are repeated at 8 in the morning and 4 in the afternoon. All those are Eastern Standard Time. And I sign off tonight, as I always do, with the anthem of the real Canada, the Maple Leaf Forever. This is Paul Fromm, and you're on the Fighting Side of Me here on White Resistance Radio. .com. And again, the internet feed is just a little bit slow, but the next song you will hear is the anthem of the real Canada, the Maple Leaf Forever, I hope. This is a little slower than I might have liked. Okay.